Hey, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction. I'm just looking at a little headline here. NATO ministers ponder funding for Ukraine. I thought, oh, that'll be good. They've finally woken up to their fucking selves that war doesn't do anybody any favours and they're going to pull the plug. But no, when you click on the link, it says NATO ministers mull billions in funding to support Ukraine. And there's a big picture there of the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, who is among the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. And he's got his gob open, of course, because he's got lots to say. The idea is that they want to Trump-proof the foreign aid for Ukraine and agree to a proposal for 100 billion euros, which is 164 US billion, over 5 years. Now, it just occurs to me that, for example, David Cameron was not elected. He's in the House of Lords. You don't get to elect those guys. So he's unelected, and he wants to impose something on Trump, who will only be able to do anything if he is elected. So a guy that wasn't democratically elected wants to overcome a guy that will be democratically elected to support a war in a country where they've suspended democracy, and we're all fighting this for democracy. I think we're fucking insane. But for us, it is episode the 349th, The Empire Strikes Back. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Yeah, look, there's really only one way to tell you this, and that is flat out. So, sorry to say it, but we are the bad guys. There, I've said it. Last week, we ended up with the unhappy death at the age of 46 of Mirza Najaf Khan. He'd been the good guy to Emperor Shah Alam. So, when I'm talking about the Empire Strikes Back, I'm actually talking about the British Empire's going to strike back. Shah Alam, yeah, he's a bit hopeless by now, really. And without Mirza Najaf Khan, he's going to probably be very useless. So there'll be a power vacuum in the court and a coup and a counter-coup, and we've got guys fighting in the streets. Oh, isn't this good, say the Jats and the Afghans. Marvellous time for us to become revolting. Shah Alam is trying to reconcile the two big factions with political marriages, but it's not working. Within a couple of years, the couple of big swinging dicks looking to take over will be assassinated, and the empire's pretty much gone again. Naughty people are trying their best to turn Delhi back into a smoking ruin. The rich are being kidnapped for ransom. The Sikhs are raiding in the northern suburbs. They're into plunder and setting fire to everything. And not one, not two, but three monsoons will fail so we can have a famine, and there goes about 20% of the Hindustan population. So, like these modern Indian guys that bang on about the British Empire being really bad, yeah, it was, but your guys did not help at all. Anyway, some big swinging dicks will provide some famine relief, but Shah Alam has no cash for it. The treasury is empty, the government has broken down. My dear listener, just so you are aware, there is a thing called succession planning. It aims to avoid all the shit that has just happened. But Shah Alam was not thinking about that ever. He relied on his imaginary friend, God. How can I describe the desolation of Delhi? There is no house from which the jackal's cry cannot be heard. The mosques at evening are unlit and deserted. Now who cares if you're Sunni or Shia when this sort of shit's going on? And it gets worse. Unburied corpses and so on. Shah Alam can't even run his own court, let alone his enemies on all sides. There's nothing for it but to write to the chubby lame Maratha Mahaji Sindhya and say, how about you come and run the show for me? Sindhya by now is a very big swinger dick. He and Tipu are the two most powerful military commanders in India. His troops are being trained by the latest Frenchy military techniques by the extremely handy Benoit de Moine, who will transform those troops into international famous troops. Well, maybe not internationally famous, but they will be known for their wall of fire and iron. And even the best trained armies in India will struggle against this lot. This is early days, but even so, lots of Scindia's enemies are learning that when his guys turn up, perhaps the smart thing is to just surrender. Part of de Boyne's tactics involves lots of killing of prisoners for people who resist. Best to just surrender and at least you get to live. So Scindia will turn up to meet with Shah Alam and again do the full prostration thingy. Scindia doesn't care. He's going to be in charge. He is nominally working for Shah Alam, but nobody much is fooled. Speaking of Scindia doesn't care, he doesn't care much for the imperial family's dietary requirements. That is, they're not getting a lot of food, and when they do, it's just the sort of stuff that you normally would feed to your slaves. Nor does he care much for their security. Off he goes to take more territory, leaving just a single battalion of troops in place. Now, the Afghan mob have got a new leader, Ghulam Qadir, who you might recall had been taken by Shah Alam when Ghulam Qadir was just a little kiddie. And I predicted to you that he would be a psycho. Shah Alam kissed and made up with the dad of Ghulam and sent Ghulam home. He is now 20 years old and he took over when his dad died off that maggoty face. Yeah, very nasty, that stuff. Ghulam thought he might like his mum's stuff too. And then he thought he might like his uncle's stuff as well. So he's got lots and lots and lots of lands. These people weren't that happy with their stuff being taken, so they're all in a slammer. There you go, they can be unhappy in a slammer. He will now be saying loudly enough that Delhi can hear that he will be heading on in to fuck that emperor right up, Shah Alam, yes. 17th of July, 1788, and they're here. People are running around yelling, "We're all going to die." "Oh, calm down," says Shah Alam. "This is Ghulam Qadir, that dear little kitty who was raised in the very court. What possibility is there that he's up to no good?" But there will be two unhappy events. Firstly, there'll be a letter into Ghulam Qadir from a former Dowager Empress who will pay if he can depose Shah Alam and get her grandson in as emperor. Secondly, our mighty leader of our single battalion of troops will just disappear in the middle of the night with all the troops, saying, "We're just off to get some reinforcements. We'll be back soon, we promise. Bye." Next morning, and Ghulam Qadir will certainly notice that the troops are no longer there. There's not even guards on the gate. Any guys, with just a few guys who will secure the gate. Then the rest of his troops and guns can start wandering in, and by the time he's got a couple of thousand guys in, he'll march on the Red Fort, where at least we've got the gates barred. Message into Shah Alam. "Hey, it's me, Ghulam Qadir. Just popped over to say hi and have a nice cup of tea. Nice cup of tea, a nice photo or two, and a good old chat will hit the spot." Message back. "Okay, come on in, but just 10 or 20 of you, not the whole 2,000, and I want an oath that you come in peace." It will be the head eunuch to go and give the message. He'd actually saved the life of Ghulam Qadir previously, so he wants to be his good buddy. On that basis, he will disobey the orders of Shah Alam, open the big old gate, and let the 2,000 hard men in. Ghulam Qadir will post his guys round the place with orders to disarm the guards and the princes. The princes can go in the slammer. Ghulam Qadir will totally breach etiquette by sitting next to the emperor on the big old peacock chair, put his arm around Shah Alam and give him a nice big smile. Ah, let the 9-week reign of terror commence. Or as the Marathas will say, the dance of the demons. Shah Alam is off to the slammer while that granny's grandson is placed on the peacock chair. "Okay, granny, pay up." And she comes to say, "Oh, just let me have a squeeze around here so I can find the money bin and then I'll pay you." "Yeah, bullshit," says Ghulam Qadir. "All that cash is mine now anyway, so no, fuck off. Go and get me the money." Ghulam Qadir will busy himself with looting. After the palace, it's anywhere in Delhi, private houses, whatever. He really is asset stripping. That's his day job, and night time will be a drug and booze-fueled fun times. Now he's got everything, he'll start thinking, "Oh, surely people must be hiding stuff from me." Servants will be hung upside down and tortured. Maids and dancing girls will be sent off for the troops to play with. Oh, I nearly forgot, our traitorous eunuch, Ghulam Kadir. He's been dragged through the latrine and tossed in the cesspit where he's up to his nostrils in shit. He'll say, hang on, mate, I saved your life previously. Ghulam Kadir will recite the old proverb, to kill a serpent and spare its young is not wise. Shah Alam is now on stale bread and water, which, oddly enough, is more than the new emperor is getting. Yeah, he can only get whatever he can scrounge. Ghulam Kadir is pretty sure the emperor is holding out on him, so we'll get a couple of princes in and say, whip them until the blood comes out of their mouths. Shah Alam will say, hey, they're young and innocent. Do it to me. Ghulam Kadir will say, blind this guy. So they'll give him a good beating first, then pop needles into the eyes of Shah Alam. Shah Alam can spend the night listening to his women and kiddies wailing. Ghulam Kadir wants them all killed, but his servants are suddenly worried about killing women and children. Yeah, we might not get into heaven if we do that. Next day, and Ghulam Kadir will threaten death on Shah Alam unless he coughs up some gold. Shah Alam will say, oh, go ahead, cut your head off, I'm over it. But no, it will be cut one eye out and pull the other one out. Well, they couldn't see anyway, but yeah, he wants them out. Then bring two princes and have them blinded. Then belt them up again and toss them in the slammer. No food or water. Five guys will try to sneak in some water and be killed with their bodies left to rot. 20 princes will have to sing and dance for the troops, like a drag show. At least that will please the psycho bastard, so he'll allow a bit of food and water into Shah Alam and the princes. A lot of those princes will die either from hunger or suicide. And now Ghulam Kadir can break the big taboo, and it's probably the last one to break. I think he's done everything else. He will go for the women. Now, you don't go for the women, mate. No, it's not on. They will be stripped and left in the sun without food and water for a while. Then it's bringing the troops for some whipping and rape, and there you go. 9 weeks of total shit for Delhi. Chubby and lame Maharaji Sindhya may not have treated Shah Alam terribly well, but Shah Alam is still his puppet emperor. He and his troops will come to the emperor's aid, but it's the monsoon, so it's slow going. Walter Reinhardt is dead by now, but his widow, Begum Sumeru, and her new boyfriend, Irish mercenary George Thomas, have turned up with some troops. The two lots of troops will team up. Sindhya will send his top military guy and the mercenary Bernay de Boyne in with some advanced troops. The gates are open. Fancy that. Straight in then. Our guys will be very cautious, taking 3 days to get to the Red Fort. Then it will be a rather large explosion. The relief force will see Ghulam Kadir and his guys with tons of treasure heading off on boats. They had blown the arsenal as they left, assuming that Shah Alam would be killed. But he survived, and some of the royal family have survived, and they'll come out bedraggled and filthy and rather skinny. Getting Shah Alam out of the slammer will be a bit tricky. Shah Alam would be rather happy just to die, thanks all the same. While some guys are organising barbers and cooks and whatever for the royals, Begum Sumeru and Bernay de Boyne are after Ghulam Kadir. They'll catch up with him, surround him. He and 500 of his horsey guys will do the charge hard and fast thing to break through the line and escape. Ghulam Kadir, being a total turd, will give his guys a slip. He just wants to sneak off, but his horsey will step in a hole and Ghulam Kadir will fall off into a ditch. And it's dark, and he's got no idea which way to go. Off he goes in the morning and will spot a village. He'll just go into the first house he sees. Ah, come in, stranger, and rest a while. I shall just pop out and nail the door shut. This very village had been fucked over by Ghulam Kadir, and our villager did not forget his face. He will dial 911 to let them know he has apprehended the psycho arsehole Ghulam Kadir. Time for him to suffer. Into this cage with you, laddie. Be a good psycho and stay still while we chain your legs. Now let's cut off your ears and hang them round your neck. Oh, look at all the laughter you're bringing to the people. That was day one. Day two will be nose, tongue and upper lip off and more parading so people can laugh at him. Day three, out with his eyes, more laughter. We're getting bored now, so off come his hands, his feet, his dick, his balls, and finally his head. The ears and eyes will be sent to Shark Alarm. Thought you might like these. Love, your pal, Cyndia. We left our eunuch who opened the gate in a cesspit, didn't we? He survived that, but he won't survive being executed by elephant trampling. Shah Alarm doesn't care. He's retreated into himself to compose poetry. The winds of calamity have been unleashed by our mutilation. Our imperial rule has been cruelly laid to waste. The exalted sun of kingship once illuminated the heavens. Now we lament the darkness of our ruin as dust descends upon us. This misbegotten son of an Afghan scattered our royal dignity. Who now, except God, could befriend us? It goes on, but you get the gist. Kabir was preparing to drop into Delhi for some really nasty shit, London was a buzz. We all want to get into the House of Lords. £50 a ticket. That's amazing. £50 a ticket to see the impeachment of Warren Hastings. We do not have enough tickets to satisfy demand. Perhaps they could put on a second show. No pre-sales, so people are lining up at 6 a.m. to get in by 9 a.m. with the show starting at noon. People are sleeping in coffee houses to make sure they're in the line nice and early. That's crazy stuff. We'll have 170 lords and lots of lawyers and 200 MPs with the Queen and a couple of princesses and a prince. And oh, there's the Prince of Wales with his mate Fox. Anybody who is anybody is there. This is a big show, the closest that we will ever get to putting the East India Company itself on trial. Let's have a sampler of the charges. With the various instances of extortion and other deeds of maladministration, with impoverishing and depopulating the whole country with a wanton and unjust and pernicious exercise of his powers in overturning the ancient establishments of the country, with cruelties unheard of and devastations almost without name, crimes which have their rise in the wicked dispositions of men in avarice, rapacity, pride, cruelty, malignity, haughtiness, insolence, ferocity, treachery, cruelty, malignity of temper. In short, nothing that does not argue a total extinction of all moral principle, that does not manifest an inveterate blackness of heart, a heart blackened to the very blackest, a heart corrupted, gangrene to the core. We have brought before you the head, the captain general of iniquity, one in whom all the frauds, all the peculations, all the violence, all the tyranny in India are embodied. Oh, fuck me. Who wants to be Warren Hastings? He's a robber. He steals. He flitches. He plunders. He oppresses. He extorts. He was a professor, a doctor upon the subject of crime. Crikey. Anything else? Yes, yes, there's more. He's a rat. He's a weasel. A keeper of the pigsty, wallowing in corruption. Like a wild beast, he groans in the corners of the dead and dying. Oh, my giddy aunt. Is he still pleased he took this job? As bad as Warren Hastings is, the company is just as bad, and they will be making the point that it is not a nation. Well, duh, but you should try and remember that when Betty issued the charter, she pretty much gave it the powers of a nation. Unlike our prosecutor, Edmund Burke, I shall not spend 4 days giving you all the allegations. We know the story, and if I've done my job correctly, you, my dear listener, would be reasonably familiar with the shitfuckery this company has been up to. Our prosecutor may be over the top, or correct, I'm not sure, when he talks about the violation of the Bengali virgin girlies and their mothers, whose nipples are torn from their bodies by agro company tax collectors. Some ladies in the audience of the House of Lords will faint. Others will have a fit of hysterics. Yeah, the hysterical thing's still going on for ladies. It's still very much fashionable to have a fit of hysterics. They will scream and boo-hoo-hoo and, oh yeah, it's just all going on. The thing is, my dear listener, the ripping off of the nipples may have happened, but I'm not a fan. For me, it seems it's a bit over the top, and secondly, you can only do that once. Tweak a nipple? Yeah, tweak a nipple as often as you like, but you can only rip it off once. You can ransack someone's house over and over, but then ransacking someone's house is not that nice, is it, really? I'm not suggesting that you actually go out and do it. So 4 days of talking this shit from Burke, then it's tag over to Richard Sheridan so he can bang on about the same sort of stuff for 4 days too. This will be all about Hastings' bad morality, the writhing obliquity of the serpent, shuffling, ambiguous, dark, insidious. Yeah, 4 days of that, but a real crowd pleaser. Even the Speaker of the House was speechless at the end. The ending will be whispered, "My lords, I have done." And with that, he will swoon backwards into the arms of Burke. The House will go absolutely nuts with applause and everybody is boo-hoo-hooing. Yes, it is all cathartic. We realise that our mighty nation is just a bit cunty. But we found our scapegoat so we can all cheer and wave and boo-hoo-hoo and get back to the cuntiness as usual, nice and soon. Edward Gibbon, the historian, will be so worried about his good mate Richard Sheridan, who's just fainted, that he'll visit the next day and ask if he's all right. Edward Gibbon will note in his diary that Sheridan was just fine. He's a good actor. That's what he wrote. He's a good actor. My dearest listener, I feel very confident that you have spotted a big fat flaw in this whole thing. They have the right idea, but the wrong guy. They could be describing Robert Clive, but they'd already decided he was a mighty hero. Parliament's already exonerated Clive, and it's a bit like Big Papa Pope. We're a bit infallible. We can't really say, oh, we might have made a mistake. No, no, no. Governments can't do that. He was commended for the great and meritorious service that he rendered to the country, that is, Clive, not the guy who actually deserves it, who's currently being impeached. Burke, who had spent 4 days on his prosecution of Warren Hastings, was instrumental in getting Clive exonerated. Yeah, there we go. Revenge being a dish best served cold was being had by Philip Francis. For those who have forgotten Philip Francis, he was the guy who had been sent to India, one of 4 commissioners to keep an eye on Hastings, and he'd been just a total arsehole from day one. It ended with a duel where Hastings wounded Francis. Francis then resigned and came back to England, where he used his Indian money to buy a nice parliamentary seat. Having gotten into Parliament, he had one goal only: bring down Warren Hastings. Francis then found his buddy in Burke, whose family had been unwise in their investments in the East India Company, so Burke also had a grudge. It will take them 5 years, but they now have their man in an impeachment trial. I certainly wish I could tell you that our man Hastings had stayed all angelic-like, but he hasn't, no. It seems that once Philip Francis left, Hastings said, oh, fuck it, everybody else is getting rich, why not me? With the wars going badly, Hastings did some rather dodgy revenue raising as well. But if Hastings has been naughty, do not think that his persecutors are sweetness and life. No way, they're motivated by revenge, and we've got a case of faked evidence. Faked by a guy who was just sentenced to death by Hastings' mate, the Calcutta Chief Justice. For Phillips and Burke, this will be called the judicial murder of a whistleblower. And that's total bullshit. Even with his current bit of shit fuckery, Hastings was still the most compassionate guy in the East India Company. He was actually popular with the Indians. Hastings was not your typical upper-class pommy arsehole as seen in the historical movies. He was tall, slim, dignified and thoughtful. Phillips was full of bile, and it shows in his articles of impeachment. This is fantasy and distortion. He is banking on Parliament not knowing a cracker about India and hoping that they will just buy the crap that he's offered up to them. It's been badly drafted and it lacks in legal details. The speeches were entertaining, yeah, everybody clapped, but it was a false history and there was just a whole heap of innuendo. Hastings' defence will need weeks to sort out the bullshit and correct it.
The thing it shows is that the British are woefully ignorant of the huge country they've been looting and running. Hastings will be cleared of all charges, but the whole ordeal has dumped a big old bout of depression on him. So it was a crap bit of work by the government, but it did show up that the company was not acting in a way that we might want it to act. There are a lot of misdeeds. There is a lot of corruption. The company has no problem using violence. And so the scene is set for a bit of oversight, some regulation and control. It will end up with the company being nationalised, but not for a long, long time yet. If you're going to give a corporation the powers of a nation, then what we've got is what you will get. And the thing needs to come back to the full ownership of the nation. And even then it's going to be awful. Hastings Day is done, he's not going back, and we need a newbie on the job. So here is General Lord Charles Cornwallis, who had recently surrendered the 13 American colonies to the British Empire. He's off to India with a brief to make sure he doesn't lose it too. You lost America? We can perhaps forgive that, but if you lose India too, mate, yeah, we'll be annoyed. Poor old Warren Hastings had gone into a famine, a wrecked dust bowl, but he certainly worked hard. His reforms meant that Cornwallis walked into a boom town with a population of around about 400,000 people. Calcutta is currently known as the City of Palaces, or the Paradise of Nations for the Mughal nobles. It's all glorious with magnificent architecture on display everywhere. There's plenty of money and growth going on. Yeah, planning regulations are not evident, sadly. That's the downside, with observers noting it could have perhaps been the most magnificent city of the time if only the British had put in a bit of design. Oh well, who cares? With all that money around the place, there are just tons of palaces. Believe it or not, the common smillies are even doing well. The price for labour has risen due to demand. About 4 years into the job, and Cornwallis is reporting that income exceeded expenditure by £2 million. After a shaky time, the company is back to profitability. Trade is going gangbusters. Cotton, muslins and silks are all selling well, as is Malwar opium, and our English have developed their taste for tea from China. Tea sales have doubled. The only thing preventing further growth in trade is that demand exceeds the amount we can supply. Yeah, we just can't keep up with it. The Calcutta Mint is knocking out over 2 million coins a year. It's all going splendidly well, so well that the company can spend 3 million a year on the military. Back in the olden days of Clive, we had 3,000 sepoys. Cornwallis turned up to find 50,000 men. The company is the best at paying guys, so they get the best soldiers. Our guys get 300 rupees a year compared to the market price of 192 rupees a year. Tipu is getting away paying his guys 48 rupees a year. Thank you then to the Indians for supplying us with so much money we can afford to splash the cash on a professional army so that we can keep that money. Yeah, thank you. Obviously, along with the best troops, we have nice ammunition factories and rather good quality guns and cannon. And we are now a military state, with the company having the best army in Asia. Tipu is talking up war, and we are all okay. Bring it on, Tipu, and watch us do you right over. Tipu's dad, Hyder Ali, has died by now, so Tipu is running the show. Hyder had left Tipu some really good advice, really, really good. The Poms are now too powerful for any one of the Indian forces to defeat them on their own. So get in the Frenchies and then help the Frenchies fight the English. The Tipu is a good operator, and that has allowed him to defeat the British 3 times already. Now he will import industrial technology from France to build up an industry. He will send envoys to China to get some silkworm eggs so he can get the silk trade going. And that trade is still going today, the one that he set up. He will create a state-based trading company with its own ships and factories. Trade centres will be established. The capital will be raised through taxes and investment. Tipu will provide gifts for the various religious houses in his patch. He's a Muslim, but he'll still spend large amounts on temples of the Hindu type and make nice speeches to go with it. Lots of his people are Hindu, and he will support the Hindus just as much as he supports the Muslims. It wasn't hard for him, as the culture of the time allowed the Muslims to embrace the Sufis and the Hindu gods and goddesses at the same time. He believed in the power of the holy men, no matter their religion. I mention all this because our traditional Western history has Tipu as a savage barbarian, but no, he was not. Look, we've just seen it. He's quite sweet, isn't he? In his own patch. Having built him up as an innovator and a respecter of religions, allow me to say that once he's off his own patch, then sure, yes, savage barbarian seems to be about the right description. He will have bits and pieces of people cut off before they're hanged. He will force circumcision on captives, oh no, and tell them that they're now Muslims. He will destroy churches and temples. He will force mass migration. And his biggest problem is that the company is expanding way faster than he can do. This Tipu guy, though, can still be an idiot, like breaking up the Shah Alam. That makes him the first Indian ruler to say no more whatever to my former sovereign, the Mughal Emperor. Homage, or whatever the Indian equivalent is. If these Indian types ever want to belt the English out, then they need to be together, not divided. Tipu had spotted that Shah Alam was a puppet, but even so, disowning the emperor will not help the Indian cause. But no, Tipu hasn't got enough enemies, so the emperor can be another one. Tipu has been doing okay on the biff, but in late 1789 he will decide to open a new front with a new enemy. Because he still doesn't have enough enemies. He is going for the Raja of Travancore, who has some nice fortifications. Nice, but not enough to withstand Tipu's big guns, which will crack those defences. In go his tidal sepoys to massacre the Raja's troops, and now his enemies are, let's see, the Marathas, the Hyderabadis, the Mughal Emperor, Travancore, and don't forget the East India Company. Tipu will kick off showing why he has that reputation for being good at the biff. His main asset is speed. Yeah, just like Scipio Africanus worked out a couple of thousand years earlier, speed can give you a big old advantage. The company army is a big old slow thingy, and Tipu is whizzing around it. There goes Trichinopoly, and there goes lots of towns and villages burned and devastated, and there goes the temple town of Tiruvannamalai. Might have murdered that. The company army just can't get into a position to get these guys into battle. The English officers travelled like kings, with servants and furniture, and lots of nice clothes to change into, and it's all nice and sedate. Our officer will need wine, brandy, gin, tea, sugar, and a nice biscuit, and of course some live poultry so he can have an egg or two for breakfast, and a nanny goat for some milk to go with his tea. Tipu and his lot have a backpack and just feed off the towns and villages. Cornwallis is looking at this, and his military reputation really is a bit smelly after he gave up America to George Washington. What has he got to say then? We have lost time and our adversary has gained reputation, which are the two most valuable things in war. I have no other part to take but to go myself and see whether I can do better. Off he goes in. He's a bit chubby by now, but a nice strong horse he will carry the old bugger. He's got 19,000 sepoys, and Shah Alam has sent Mir Alam with 18,000 Mughal cavalry. See, if Tipu had stayed as vassal of Shah Alam, then the empire probably would not have sent those guys. And of course we have to take an orchestra with us to play the theme, don't we? The plan is to head deep into Tipu territory, but there is a big old problem in that Tipu's army has been through there laying waste to their own stuff, so getting food is a big problem. And it's not just the men. The animals have no food, and there go 10,000 bullocks, with the still alive bullocks not in much of a condition for carting guns around the place. Men have to start carrying artillery, Oh, here comes disease, and oh, look, the monsoon is early, spoiling our rice rations. And now, hello, smallpox. Oh, dear. Cornwallis will have to abandon his guns and start a retreat. Half a day into the retreat, and there are 2,000 enemy horsey types in front of us. Oh, no. Let's fire some shots at them, but then, oh, hang on a tick. They aren't enemy types, no. It's the Marathas who have turned up with plenty of supplies for men and bullocks. And it's not all just kindness, though. We will have to pay heavily inflated prices for the goods, but listen, it's better than dying. We now have 3 allied armies, so off to Bangalore to wait for it to stop raining. The rains are over, and off we go again for some besieging of fortresses and to secure a nice supply route, so to ensure there won't be a repeat of logistics problems. Between the 3 armies, there's about 45,000 guys, while Tipu's got about 50,000 guys. Tipu, though, does not want to risk his army in open battle, so he'll be sitting safe and snug in his fortress at Srirangapatnam, maybe. It was designed by the Frenchies using the latest scientific methods, as outlined by the Marquis de Montembeau in his book La Fortification Perpendiculaire. Cornwallis will just launch an attack. No telling his allies, he's just going to start bombardment on a moonless night. This was an absolute surprise, motherfucker, with Tipu thinking Cornwallis would surely wait until all the forces had arrived and set up. Tipu has abandoned his fortified encampment and retreated to an island citadel. Cornwallis can wander on in and take another fortress at the eastern end of the island, and there it goes too. And now, sadly, boo-hoo-hoo for your podcaster, because with that fortress came the magnificent Red Garden, which will now be levelled. Lots of trees will, sadly, die. Rose gardens belted up for gun emplacements. Oh, boo-hoo-hoo, my dear listener. I get sad when the gardens get killed. Tipu will start fighting back, but it's too little too late, and his troops could see it. They have started to wander off home to put the kettle on and have a nice lie down. Tipu will be forced to seek terms, and the terms will be harsh. Half the kingdom will have to become East India Company territory. 30 million rupees will be paid as an indemnity. You can release all the POWs and send us your 2 elder sons as hostages. There, that should do. The borderlands will be handed over to the Marathas, and the company want the spice lands at Malabar. Oh, God, we want a lot. Well, Tipu's stuffed. He's got to agree. There go the 2 princes, aged 8 and 5 with Cornwallis. They will go to Madras, which they liked, except the bit where they had to sit through an opera by Handel. The boys will impress Madras society and be sent home a couple of years later when the indemnity is fully paid. Tipu has lost 70 forts, 800 guns, he's got 50,000 dead, and now half the kingdom is to go. But before you know it, he has snuck off to the Marathas to say, "I am not your enemy. The English are our enemy, and you must beware." You see, Tipu, you keep attacking your fellow Indians, and then you are their enemy, you wanker. The company so far, and I mean so far for the entire time we've been in India, so far it's been playing defence. Under Cornwallis, they will turn their attention to offence. They're going to get into it. Before this latest action against Tipu, they held about 9% of the Indian land. That has just increased bigly, knocking off 50% of Tipu's stuff. Cornwallis also knows that in America, the English lost to the descendants of the Europeans and not to the locals. We don't want that happening in India, so it will be some nicely racist legislation. You see, my dear listener, lots of young English guys fell to the temptation of the dusky maidens. And not just for a romp in the elephant manure. No, they married those dusky maidens and have cappuccino-coloured kitties. Darlings, I'm sure. And Cornwallis has just legislated that those cute kitties will not be employed by the company. Some guys, like General Sir David Ochterlony, went for dusky Muslim chicky babes, which meant that the harem idea was okay for them. David had 13 wives, unless you're English, then David had 13 concubines. He was the guy who, if you remember our heroine Charlotte, I've got to get back to Charlotte's story, but anyway, do you remember Charlotte? She was hoping to marry him. Charlotte, who got raped a couple of times, you remember that? Surely. And so far has written a book about her, or perhaps a friend's, experience in France during the Reign of Terror. The point is, there are a lot of these coffee-coloured kiddies around, and we aren't convinced that they would be loyal to Britain. If they got powerful enough, they might get together and boot the white guys out. This racist stuff will just continue, and before you know it, mixed-race kiddies can't own land. They will end up in jobs like minor clerks, postmen and train drivers, and it won't be long before we ban our guys from marrying those dusky maidens. Yeah, it's a bit awful, isn't it? Cornwallis isn't stopping with the mixed-race kiddies. The old admin staff of the Muggles will find they're booted out of the top jobs. They're too corrupt, says the guy running an extremely corrupt organisation. He should know, I suppose. Now that we are out as racists, we can formally start treating Indians as our inferiors. That includes changes to our rules of etiquette as we apply them to Indian dignitaries. The dignity of the dignitaries will take a hit. Cornwallis will introduce some land and tax reforms. The land we have just taken will be leased out. An annual fixed land tax will need to be paid. If you fail to pay, then the land is simply taken away from you and sold to someone else who will pay. This will cause a revolution of land holdings. Large estates are split up, with former servants lining up to buy their bit of their ex-master's estate. Tax assessments will see about half that land resold over time as people fail to pay. Peasant farmers will now find out that they didn't have it quite so bad under the old rich guys as they do now under the company. The Indians have been fucked over once more, but great news for the company. Oh yes, this rental income will stabilise the revenues and increase them, of course, by the amount of leases, and the large taxes are paid on time and in full. Some Indians, of course, are doing very well under this new system, and we have gained a whole lot of pro-British Indians. Bankers, traders, large landowners, those sort of guys. The rich, they're getting richer. The company can rely on these guys to keep it tight at a local level. An elite group of upper-middle-class Indian types will emerge and work closely with the company, helping the company to expand its army, buy arms and ammunition, and continue its takeover of India. And once again, modern Indian guys, just remember, your lot helped the company to do it. There you go. It's the rich. That's what it's always about. It's the rich people. Working with the Indian merchants, bankers, mercenaries, nawabs and rajahs, the company has an edge over their Indian rivals. It's no longer military technology that makes the big difference. It's the ability to put the largest and best trained army in Asia into the field. Large amounts of money to maintain the army can be moved around the country with ease. The big finance houses will make sure that everything goes smoothly. The Jagat Seth bankers are out now, and the House of Gopaldas is the new company banker. The company had helped them break into the Western Indian market. The company also spoke the right language for the bankers. They get it. They get banking and finance, whereas the local rulers, they might not be that good at it. By the end of the century, the company will be making around 25 million rupees, whereas the rather smart Sindhya running the Marathas will struggle to make a million. Guys like Sindhya and Tipu simply can't match the company or its armed forces. They don't have the sort of money needed for that. So even more reason for the bankers to back the company. The Marathas are down to belting each other, as are the other guys around the place. The English can hop in once the belting is done, put in puppet leaders and reduce the common smellies to a state not much advanced on slavery. It's what the Romans did. Take over an area, put in a client king who knows they work for Rome Inc., and off you go. Unlike individual rulers, the company is technically immortal and can operate on a different time scale. Slowly and steadily, it can increase its holding of India. Nothing can stop it. Oh, fuck, he's Napoleon! TP is pretty bloody excited. He can see a fantastic opportunity here, and we'll send an embassy to Napoleon in France. And once again, it's a bit like history repeating. Yeah, oddly enough. It's a bit like Verica of the Atrebates turning up to Claudius saying, can you invade Britain to do over Caractacus for me? Oh, absolutely, says Napoleon. Oh, well, said Claudius first, but Napoleon will say it as well. Believe it or not, to be old mate, I was about to do that anyway. Step one for me is knock over Egypt. That shouldn't be too hard. Napoleon wrote, through Egypt we shall invade India. We shall re-establish the old route through Suez and cause the route by the Cape of Good Hope to be abandoned. Then Napoleon will write to Tipu from Cairo. You have already been informed of my arrival on the borders of the Red Sea with an innumerable and invincible army, full of the desire of releasing and relieving you from the yoke of England. I eagerly embrace this opportunity of testifying to you the desire I have of being informed by you, by the way, of Muscat and Mocha, as to your political situation. I wish you could send some sort of intelligent person to Suez or Cairo, possessing your confidence, with whom I might confer. May the Almighty increase your power and destroy your enemies. Yours, etc., etc., Bonaparte. Ladies and gentlemen, as if having the bloody Frenchies in there would be any better than the English. Crikey. As Napoleon was sailing off to Alexandria, a new Governor-General was sailing into India. Welcome a new Governor-General, Richard Marcus Wellesley. He is the older brother of his more famous sibling, Arthur Wellesley, who will become the Duke of Wellington. Arthur, oddly enough, had recently been posted to India too. So we've got the two brothers operating in India, one being the governor, the other being the military guy. And they will certainly have an impact on the place. The brothers at this moment aren't anything extraordinary. Just a couple of ordinary guys. Anglo-Irish types. Self-confident. Quick thinkers. Bit aggro. Offence is better than defence types. Richard is the star of the family at this time. Well, he's Governor General. And here he is, taking over from Cornwallis. Richard has two clear goals. Secure the entire country for British rule and boot out all Frenchies. Our Foreign Minister Dundas had told Richard to clean out the Indians contaminated by Frenchy influence. Mainly Tipu of Mysore, Nizam Ali Khan of the Hyderabad, and the Marathas. All three mobs have got troops trained by French mercenaries, and we are worried that the Frenchies could come on in and use them. The British are in a tough spot. They're at war with France, Spain, and the Dutchies. And our ally, the Sausages, are just doing a peace deal with France. Napoleon's looking pretty bloody good, and we know he's got plans to turn up in Ireland, which is on the verge of rebellion, so we can't really take many chances with India. Richard will luck out when his ship stops off at the Cape. There is Major William Kirkpatrick having a break, and he can tell Richard all about it. That includes some pretty fanatical Frenchy revolutionaries turning up with rather good skills. Tipu has 500 of these Frenchy guys to lead troops, provide advice, and give tech support. They've established the Revolutionary Club and hoisted the tricolour, burning the old Bourbon flags. Liberty trees have been planted, and oaths sworn that they hate all kings, except Tipu, of course. So we have these guys with Frenchy mercenaries, and if those Frenchy mercenaries start forming gangs, we can get done over. Wellesley will then be right into planning to take on Tipu. And those plans will become super urgent when we get the news that the Frenchies have done that deal with Tipu. Tipu has said, as soon as you can get more hard men here, then we will beat the British out of India. Tipu may have sealed his own fate. We need to get Tipu, as the Poms call him, before any Frenchy types can get over here. Step one is to neutralise Michel Joachim Marie Raymond, a Frenchy general in the army of Nizam Ali Khan. Yeah, that's going to be tricky. Wellesley was pretty smart to work out that this guy was a threat. He was the one who worked out the need for the various Frenchies and their Indian allies to team up against the British. He is in correspondence with the Frenchies of the Marathas and the Frenchies with Tipu. This is really a big problem to neutralise this guy. Raymond is very wealthy indeed. He's got 14,000 hard men around him. He's also got a gun foundry. And, like, he is super popular with the Indians. The heir to the big Hyderabad chair, Sikandar Jah, swears by Raymond's head. Raymond will suddenly die of mysterious circumstances, age 43. We'll never know for sure, but we seem to have a James Bond-style assassin working for the company. With Raymond out of the way, it is the not-so-simple but effective method of saying, "Hey there, Hyderabad types, come on over and look at our big manly armed forces." In they go for a squeeze and they can see the company's forces and the writing is on the wall. They need an alliance with the Poms because the Poms are the biggest and scariest thing around. Now, this had to be done on the quiet because there were still plenty of Frenchy mercenaries hanging around even though Raymond has gone to heaven. It will be surprise, motherfuckers, and hey, to show you that we Poms are really the good guys, we will pay you all outstanding wages and you can piss off, just leave your guns behind. Make up your mind, you've got 15 minutes. 14,000 Frenchies will surrender to 4,000 Poms. No shots fired, nobody harmed. And that is the largest Frenchy force in India done. Well, turned out to be easy. And hey, Frenchies, as you march off, we just got the news that our guy Nelson has totally done over your ships in the Battle of the Nile. All that worry for us that Napoleon would be turning up here is gone. Sucks to be you. Wellesley will write happy letters home to Secretary Dundas. Big victory for us and Tipu is next on my list to do. Wellesley will write to Tipu. Hey, buddy, we just did over 14,000 Frenchies. Given that you are our good buddy, I thought I'd let you know because this news is sure to make you happy. Tipu will write back saying, "Oh, I'm just chilling out doing a bit of hunting in my pleasure grounds." Wellesley will change tone of his letters, assuring Tipu that we are about to fuck him right up. Tipu will reply, "I'm still hunting, but please send me more of your marvellous letters." Wellesley has lined up the finance for his campaign, easy peasy, because the banks all love him, and he wants the Marathas on side. Hey, O mighty Peshwa of the Marathas, remember that treaty you signed off with Cornwallis? Well, we want to cash it in. The Peshwa will reluctantly agree to provide 25,000 troops who will turn up too late for action, but that's okay. Now, just to demonstrate that we are heading nicely towards modern warfare, it will be step up the bullshit rhetoric against Tipu. A cruel and relentless enemy, a beast of the jungle, an intolerant bigot with a rooted hatred of Europeans who had perpetually on his tongue the projects of jihad. This tyrant also deemed to be oppressive and an unjust ruler, a sanguinary tyrant, a perfidious negotiator, and above all, a furious fanatic. No redeeming features whatsoever. They just haven't called him a terrorist, have they? But we're not into terrorists yet. Wellesley will write to the company. In order to get peace, we need war. Yeah, standard line, isn't it? He will write to Tipu. All I intend to do is preserve the peace. Sure, you might see me preparing for a war, but that's necessary, my dear Tipu, because of the present crisis going on. But it is peace only that I want. Yeah, it might be a bit of a fib there. Nah, kidding. It's a big fat lie. Wellesley will be off to Madras to meet with the governor there, Edward Clive, the son of Robert Clive. The stupid government thought that Edward Clive would be smart like Robert Clive, but Edward is a bit on the thick side. Willesley will write that Edward was a nice guy, but he has no idea how Edward got to be the bloody governor. Willesley, though, is not looking for help in taking on Tipu. No, Clive, you can just stay home. Soldiers are getting into place with 1,400 elite Grenadier Guards under the command of Arthur Wellesley, the future Duke of Wellington. Tipu will make a last-ditch effort to get more guys onto Team India, warning the other big dicks that no matter what their differences are, the real enemy is the British. He is so desperate he's even going to write to the Afghans. Yes, in that one he has said that they should also knock over Shah Alam so they can divide India between themselves. See, Tipu, you're sending out mixed messages, mate. Anyway, all this is too late, and Tipu can record a bad dream he had with a huge Christian army coming his way, and the guys all had the heads of pigs. That's not nice for a Muslim, I guess. In come the British with a very large force. Tipu, having already lost half his kingdom, will be back on his island fortress playing defence. Tipu is still a very formidable enemy, and the siege won't be easy. It goes on, and Tipu can spring various surprises, which makes it start to look like there will be a need to be a big assault with a fair whack of death. Hang on. We British have unprecedented amounts of artillery to bang away, and there's various types of artillery. So we've got the heavy guns to breach the walls, and then the smaller howitzers to send nasty stuff through those breaches, and a lot of even smaller cannon that's just used against humans. Constant bombardment will see Tipu's guns disabled, and we get some good breaches ready for an assault. Tipu's astrologers will be saying, yeah, this won't be going well. It may not be the position of the stars, my dear listener, but more the big holes in the walls and all those enemy soldiers ready to pour in. Here we go, and before you know it, the British are deep into the place and on the walls. Tipu will come out with his elite Line of God battalion. He'll cop a couple of bayonet wounds and a shot to his left shoulder, and his guys will say, "Should you surrender, boss?" Tipu will say, "Are you mad? Be silent." Tipu's got some gold stuff hanging off his clothes somewhere, so the British soldiers want that, or the Indian soldiers. He will cop not one, but two bullets at point-blank range through his head, and that is it. Off to heaven for Tipu with about 10,000 of his soldiers. The company had lost about 350 only, but now let the killing commence. Rape, loot, plunder, kill, kill, kill. Arthur Wellesley will start floggings and executions to get the troops under control. The British will allow a big old funeral for Tipu, and they can't help but notice that he seemed to have been beloved. Hindu or Muslim, doesn't matter. They love the guy. Perhaps it's because he ran a nice, prosperous kingdom where you could make money. In fiora e la fuggevo il fuggevo l'ora si ne via voluta li pianne dolci premiti e suscita l'amore poiché quell'occhio al cuore onnipotente va. Yeah, a little bit of Birdie there and La Traviata, which was on my dear old mum's playlist very bloody regularly when I was a boy. And that guy is singing to the other guys saying, get on the booze with me and then we'll get into these hot chicky babes, because the hot chicky babes are even hotter if you've had a few under the belt, to which I say, mate, have you heard of Brewer Street? It is a real, real thing. To get us into some historical fiction, and this week it's a TV series, Mary and George. Mary and George, of course, being the Villiers. And this guy, George Villiers, will end up being the Duke of Buckingham, who we all dislike. So, yeah, a bit tricky for me, because I don't like Mary, I don't like George, I don't like Jim, I don't like Robert Carr, the Earl of Somerset, I don't like his Mrs. Frances Howard. There's a nice servant girl,
who George is a bit hot for. But apart from her, I don't like anybody in it. And I don't even know why I'm watching it. But, like, it's a well-made series. And I guess it's a look at what life might have been under King Jim 1 and 6 there, which, like, I just think it's awful. Like, if the king cracks some sort of shitty joke, you're supposed to laugh. And you've got a fawn over him. And I don't think I could do it. Anyway, Mary and George, if you want to watch it, it's a well-made TV show. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. So what about a bit of Imagine Dragons and Thunder? Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Just a young gun with a quick fuse. I was uptight, wanna let loose. I was dreaming of bigger things and wanna leave my old life behind. Not a yes sir, not a follower. Fit the box, fit the mold, have a seat in the foyer. Take a number, I was lightning before the thunder.
Thunder.
Kids were laughing in my classes while I was scheming for the masses.